Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In the early 1970s, Santa Cruz, California, became known as the murder capital of the world because of two serial killers operating in the area and a senseless mass murder that occurred on October 19, 1970. The mass murder filled the community with fear, leading them to believe there was another Manson family operating in the area. Okay, on to the show. The Otas were a Japanese-American family who lived in the Soquel area, a Santa Cruz suburb, on October 19, 1970. Dr. Victor Oto was a prominent ophthalmologist who had started practicing in the area in 1960. He was born in Montana on May 5, 1924, to Japanese parents. Oto had attended medical school at Northwestern University, where he met his wife, Virginia Ann Tobias, or Toby to her friends. The two wed while Victor was still in medical school. After medical school, Victor joined the U.S. Air Force, where he reached the rank of major, before leaving to focus on his practice in Santa Cruz. The Otas had four children. Tara, the oldest daughter, was 18 in 1970. She attended a design school in New York. Lark, the second daughter, was 14 in 1970 and attended the Santa Catalina School for Girls in Monterey. Derek, 12 years old, was a student at Thorpe Manor Private School, and Taggart, or Tag, was 11. He was a sixth grader at the Good Shepherd School. The Otas were known for being humble and kind, and although wealthy, were not considered standoffish or snobbish. Dr. Oto was known for being a very competent eye surgeon, and his patients loved him. Many of his patients said they could only see because of his skills as an eye surgeon. Dr. Lewis Weilman, president of the Medical Plaza Association, of which Dr. Oto was a member and where he had his practice, said that Dr. Oto was a perfectionist at everything he did. Dr. Weilman also said, quote, "Never once did I hear him speak an angry word to anybody. He was a compassionate, nonviolent type of person who was an expert at using his hands." Dr. Oda's hobbies included gardening and woodwork, and if he did not get it just right, he would start all over. Everyone agreed that Dr. Oda was a family man, and Dr. Weilman said this was why he had created such a beautiful home at 999 Rodeo Gulch Road. He spent almost all of his free time there with his family and wanted it to be as beautiful as possible. Mrs. Oto agreed with this philosophy, having once said, "When I die, I want to leave something beautiful behind me." Duane Weber, who ran a service station, recalled that in 1965, he was inflating a tire tube when the tire exploded in his face. He said everything turned black. "The first doctor that observed me said there wasn't much hope that I would see again, but Dr. Oto was called, and because of his diagnosis, I was able to see again." The Soquel Fire Chief, Ray Negro, said that the Otas were very humble people who always had time to talk to others. All that ended on October 19, 1970, when a bright and caring family, plus the mother of another family, had an encounter with a stranger who had a divine duty to carry out. The first clue that something was wrong occurred when Mrs. Ota, who was always prompt in picking up her two sons from their respective schools, did not arrive to pick up either son. She had a routine, first picking up one son at 2:45 p.m., then going to the second school to get the other son. However, on this day at 4:30 p.m., one of their sons called Dr. Ota and said that he was still at school, as his mother had never shown up. Dr. Oda could not understand what had happened and so sent his secretary, Mrs. Dorothy Cadwallader, to pick his son up. Just moments later, their other son called to say the same thing. He was still at school and Mom was nowhere to be seen. Dr. Oda finished up with his patient and then went to pick up his son himself. After picking up his son, They stopped at Dr. Oda's mother's house for a few minutes before continuing home for the evening. Investigators believe Dr. Oda and son arrived home shortly before 6 o'clock p.m., and that Mrs. Cadwallader and the other son had arrived sometime earlier. The Ota's gardener said he had arrived at work at 7:30 a.m. that morning and worked until about noon. He returned later in the day and worked until 3:30 p.m. He told authorities he had not witnessed Mrs. Oda leaving the residence, and she did not answer the door when he knocked around 3 o'clock p.m. Dr. Oda's watch stopped at 6:42 p.m., which investigators believe is when he was tossed into the pool. The autopsy report shows that all five victims were killed between 6 and 8 o'clock p.m. Dr. Oda was shot with a .38 caliber weapon 3 times, while the others were shot with a .22 caliber once. There were no powder burns on their bodies. It's not clear how long the killer or killers stayed at the Oda residence, but they picked up after themselves. No spent shell casings were found. A fire was set to the Oda home, and it was reported at around 8 o'clock p.m., but fire investigators said it could have been started as much as 2 hours before the report. When the fire department was called, the road to the Oda residence was blocked by the Oda's red Rolls Royce and Miss Cadwallader's gold and black Lincoln. Firefighters had to move the cars before they could get to the residence to combat the blaze. Fire Chief Ted Pound discovered the bodies when he went looking for an additional source of water and hoped to use the Oda's pool. The five bodies were all found in the pool, with their hands tied in the front with colorful silk scarves. Dr. and Mrs. Oda were both bound hand and foot. Three of the victims had silk scarves over their eyes, and 2 extra scarves were floating in the pool. These scarves belonged to Dr. Oda, who favored them over ties. One of the women was still floating in the pool, while the others had settled to the bottom. There was blood on the deck, and a stream of blood 4 or 5 inches wide on the water. Dr. and Mrs. Oda were scheduled to attend a Founders Day dinner that night at the Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, which Dr. Oda had helped establish. However, when the bodies were discovered, they were still in casual wear and had not started preparations for the dinner. Investigators were unsure of why Mrs. Cadwallader was there. They assumed to babysit, but her husband quickly dispelled that theory. Her husband also let the press know that neither the police nor any other official notified him of his wife's death. He was notified by the mortuary, asking him to identify the body. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. He stayed up all night with a gun to protect their 8-month-old adopted daughter, Darcy, and their 11-year-old daughter, Melinda. 8 years before, their 8-year-old son, Wayne, was ran over by a mail truck and killed. Dorothy had worked for Dr. Oda for 8 years. Police and arson investigators were quickly called. It was determined that the fire was the work of arson. One of the Oda's vehicles was missing, a green station wagon. At 1:30 the next morning, police issued a BOLO, or a be on the lookout, for the vehicle. It was found 2 days later abandoned and ablaze in the Rincon Railroad Tunnel below Felton. A slow-moving train had crashed into the car. Not long before, the car was seen in a field in Bonnie Doon with a backpack on the back deck. But before law enforcement could reach the area, the car was gone. Once the car was discovered, law enforcement swarmed the area, searching for evidence of the killer or killers. There were 3 sets of footprints around the vehicle in the tunnel, supporting the theory that there was more than one person involved. These murderers struck fear in the community, who believed that another Manson family was operating in the area. The violence of the crime and the fact a note had been found at the scene led many to believe this. Additionally, in a press conference, when asked if the sheriff believed these murders had a cultish or mystical significance, the sheriff replied, "Yes." The typed note was found under the windshield wiper of the Rolls-Royce and read, quote, "Today, World War II will begin, as brought to you by the people of the free universe. From this day forward, anyone and or company of persons who misuses the natural environment or destroys same will suffer the penalty of death by the people of the free universe. I and my comrades from this day forward will fight until death or freedom against anything or anyone who does not support natural life on this planet. Materialism must die, or mankind will. The note was signed Knight of Wands, Knight of Cups, Knight of Pentacles, Knight of Swords, all cards from the tarot deck. The Sheriff's Department asked the members of the public and the media to please honor the Oda's family privacy at their funeral service. Once the contents of the note were made public, several members of the hippie community came forward with information about one person. All these people pointed the finger at John Lindley Frazier, stating he had pointed the finger at Dr. Victor Oda and his materialism before. One of the informants told District Attorney Peter Chang that the writing of the note was right on for Frazier. However, police were also led on another possible line of investigation. On Wednesday night, two nights after the murders, three people who were acting strangely and were barefoot walked into a Monterey restaurant around midnight. The three asked the owner if he served food in nature's manner. The two men were about 26 and 32, and the woman was around 20. She was waving a red wand and seemed dazed and confused. The restaurant owner was terrified and asked that the name of his restaurant be kept out of the papers. Despite this other possible line of investigation, police focused on Frazier and a manhunt soon began. Frazier was described as armed and dangerous, as he was believed to be armed with the .38 caliber that had been used to kill Dr. Oda. His description read, John Lindley Frazier, 24, brownish blonde collar-length hair, very light, full beard, medium build, last seen wearing beige straw hat with red, white, and blue hat band, a green coat and dark trousers. He was wearing high-top moccasins. Frazier lived within a mile of the Oda home and was arrested there around 7:30 a.m. on Friday morning, October 23, 1970. He put up no resistance and was taken into custody by deputies Bradley Arbsland and Rodney Sanford. They had waited for 20 hours, hidden in the dense brush nearby. Frazier's cabin was a converted milk barn. It was one of a half dozen buildings his mother, Pat Pascal, had rented to college students or hippies. When taken to jail, he only asked for a glass of water. Frazier was identified out of a lineup as the man seen driving Mrs. Oda's car wildly toward Felton the morning after the killings. Three out of six people picked Frazier out of the lineup. Two people identified Frazier as a driver who nearly ran them off the road with his erratic driving. Frazier was arraigned the same afternoon of his arrest on five counts of murder. The judge asked him if he was also known by Pascal, which Frazier vehemently denied. His public defender, James Jackson, entered a not guilty plea on all counts on his behalf. A preliminary hearing was set for the following Wednesday, but District Attorney Peter Chang wanted to bypass that and go straight to the grand jury and avoid municipal court and just go to Superior Court. After the Oda murders, before the trial began, the hippie community in Santa Cruz felt backlash from a community that blamed them for the murders. The Catalyst, a restaurant known as a hangout for hippies, received at least four bomb threats. A note was found at the shop next door to the Catalyst that read, "Now, tell me, what good are hippies? Hippies are pollution. Causes dope. Dope causes mind pollution. Mind pollution causes murder. The only good hippie is a dead one." There was a drawing of a bomb on one side of the note and on the other, a noose with "Reserved for Hippies" written under it. Side note, a few years later, serial killer Herbert Mullen would begin operating in Santa Cruz and would talk about people being pollution. He killed one girl and opened up her body, convinced she was full of pollution. Despite this note and the insinuation that hippies should die, Sheriff James praised the citizens of Santa Cruz for their cool and good judgment. James said that if radicalism had won out, things could have really blown up. He said, quote, "We trust our citizens will continue to exercise sound judgment, and that he was one of ours. We have a responsibility in this too." James praised his deputies for their hard work and dedication, saying, "Hopefully, you're as proud of them as I am." There was some concerns that information was not broadcast to other law enforcement agencies as quickly as it should have been, such as information about the missing vehicle, whose BOLO was issued at 1:30 a.m. after the murders. Sheriff James said that the pressure to solve the killings quickly brought to light the tremendous need for extra personnel and equipment, which was touched on during the court cases later. High-intensity lights were installed on the front of the sheriff's office the same day Frazier was arrested. The sheriff denied there was any around-the-clock deputies outside, but said, "We are maintaining strict surveillance." With a suspect behind bars, the public wanted to know more about John Lindley Frazier. Some of Frazier's classmates from school recalled that he was a tough guy and would be in the midst of any fight that was going on. One teacher said that he was liked by most people, including the staff. Other classmates of Frazier said he was definitely a troublemaker. One of these students had seen Frazier not long before the murders and described his manner of dress as far out. Another classmate remembered a slave day started at school. He couldn't remember if Frazier organized the event or not, but recalled it involved boys leading their girlfriends around by strings tied around their necks. The students were told by the school authorities to stop it, but Frazier kept it up all day. Despite his social standing at school, Frazier hated it and dropped out of Santa Cruz High School just a few weeks after he started. He got a job at a service station and eventually became an auto mechanic, working at several garages in the area. He worked at an Aptos station in 1965 through 1966, which was owned by a Boulder Creek, Colorado man. The unnamed owner said that Frazier was kind of peculiar, short-tempered, and used a lot of profanity. Frazier was not married at this time. However, one of the owners of Putney and Perry Auto Repair, where Frazier worked from November 1968 to August 1969, said that most of the people who worked with Frazier liked him. He went on to say that they had no problems with him. He was a good worker, punctual, and conscientious. He only left to take a job to make more money. He said that Frazier did not look like a hippie when he worked at Putney and Perry Auto Repair. Until about 6 months before the murders, Frazier had been ordinary and not prone to violence. 6 months prior, he had been in an automobile accident in Scotts Valley, and it is believed he had suffered a traumatic brain injury, which altered his personality. According to friends, his personality changed after the accident, and he began living in a cabin in the woods and holing up with his Bible for hours at a time. He had also stopped driving, claiming God said by driving, I was polluting the environment and I would be killed if I drove anymore. Of course, he also began taking LSD and mescaline after the accident. Frazier was known as a real freak by other hippies, who said he was extremely obsessed about natural living and the environment. At the time of the crimes, Frazier was married, although investigators would not release information about his wife. Mrs. Frazier did tell investigators that they were not living together at the time. She was living in the San Lorenzo Valley, and she helped Frazier clean out his Soquel cabin. He stayed overnight with her the Saturday before the killings. He left on Sunday and did not return again. He took with him a loaded pistol he had tucked in his waistband, a backpack with rations for several days, and a pair of binoculars that she later found out he had stolen from the Otas on a previous burglary. He left his driver's license and wallet at his wife's house, telling her he would no longer need them. A friend of Frazier's told police that Frazier had said, "Big things are going to happen next Monday." Frazier is reported to have said about people who lived as the Otas did that they are too materialistic and should be snuffed. While incarcerated and awaiting trial, Frazier freed the razor from his safety blade and slashed his wrist. A fellow inmate noticed the blood, asked for help on the jail intercom system, and Frazier was taken to a local hospital. He was seen immediately, given 5 or 6 stitches in the wound, and then taken back to the jail, all in about 50 minutes. On October 18, 1971, nearly a year after the murders, Frazier finally went to trial. His attorney entered a modified plea of innocent by reason of insanity. The trial lasted for 4 weeks. One of the witnesses called during the trial and sentencing phase was psychologist David Marlowe, a UCSC psychology professor who had interviewed Frazier 35 to 40 times during his incarceration in the Santa Cruz County Jail. Dr. Marlowe explained that Frazier frequently contradicted himself and provided Marlowe with vague versions of the details on October 19, 1970. He gave Marlowe 3 accounts of that day, and the 3rd account is the only account ever provided as to how the killings occurred. Frazier informed Marlowe he arrived at the Oda residence alone early in the afternoon of October 20, 1970. He was armed with 2 handguns, a .22 caliber and a .38 caliber. Virginia Oda was the first one to arrive home. Frazier took her to a bedroom, bound her with scarves, and assured her that she would not be raped. He then lectured Mrs. Oda of the evil way she lived and how she and her family were ruining the environment with their materialism. Mrs. Cadwallader arrived next, and he tied her up, but he made no mention of the boy she brought with her. Dr. Oda and his son arrived next, and they were tied up. Frazier accused Dr. Oda of destroying the Santa Cruz Mountains and destroying life and the environment. The psychologist said that Frazier freaked out when he saw animal skins in the Oda home. However, Frazier did not notice the animal skins were fakes. Dr. Oda told Frazier he would give him whatever he wanted if he would just leave, which incensed Frazier even more at this lurid display of materialism. Frazier suggested they burn the house down together and return the area to its natural state. This angered Dr. Oda, so Frazier pushed him into the pool. Frazier did not explain to the doctor how they came to be at the pool area. In the pool, Dr. Oda managed to free his hands. He swam to the edge, and Frazier offered him his arm. According to Frazier, Dr. Oda lunged for him, so he shot at Dr. Oda. Frazier brought Mrs. Oda down next, asked her if she believed in God. When she replied, yes, he said, then you have nothing to be afraid of, and shot her. He did the same with Mrs. Cadwallader, then shot the 2 boys, shooting the youngest boy last. Marlowe said that in another version of events, Frazier arrived at the Oda home with 3 other people in a van around noon, or arriving himself at 10:30 a.m., and the others arriving later in the day. Marlowe said that Frazier was dangerous and insane today. He also said that Marlowe was a paranoid schizophrenic. He explained that a schizophrenic has gross disturbances of thoughts and feelings and cannot adequately behave within societal norms. A paranoid suffers from delusions of grandeur or prosecution. Frazier was fascinated by weapons and would spend a great deal of time watching the woods to ensure no one was sneaking up on him. After the testimony and closing arguments, the jury took 3 days to return a guilty verdict on all 5 counts of first-degree murder. Frazier heard the guilty verdicts with a smile on his face and showed no signs of anguish. The sentencing phase began next. On the first day of the sentencing hearing, Frazier showed up with half of his head shaved, including his eyebrows. He said that this represented the duality of a hippie. He eventually shaved his entire head, including both eyebrows. He was sentenced to death in the gas chamber. However, in 1972, California abolished the death penalty, so his sentence was automatically commuted to life in prison. On August 13, 2009, John Lindley Frazier completed suicide in his prison cell at Mule Creek State Prison by hanging himself. He had repeatedly been denied parole, most recently in 2007. Tara Oda, the Oda's oldest daughter, married and had a daughter, but not quite 7 years after the Oda's murders, Tara took her own life, never fully recovering from the loss of her family. Lark is the only surviving member of the Oda family. Lark admitted in a 1990 newspaper article that life has been difficult without her family, particularly her mother, and that her own experiences of motherhood were not as rosy as her mother made it seem. Dr. Oda's mother, Aiko Oda, also completed suicide in 1979. Her life had been one of great loss. Not only had she lost her son, grandsons, and daughter-in-law, but her husband had died just 5 years before the murders. Also, she had lost a daughter in July of 1970, quite unexpectedly. She also had lost another son, Hiroshi Ota, in 1951, when the plane he was flying crashed just minutes after takeoff. Her last remaining child, Roy Ota, passed away in 1990. Peter Cheng, the district attorney who prosecuted the case, passed away on December 11, 2005 from lung cancer. He had been diagnosed just 2 months previously. At the time he was elected, he was the youngest DA in the U.S. Cheng prosecuted not just Frazier, but also Edmund Kemper during the period between 1970 and 1973. DA Cheng infamously described Santa Cruz as Murderville under his breath, at a serial killer's dumping ground. But a reporter overheard him and changed this to Murder Capital of the U.S. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Audio engineering and custom music for the show was provided by Nico at WeTalkOfDreams.com. Follow him on Twitter at WeTalkOfDreams and let him know how great he's doing. This episode was researched and written by Suzanne St. John. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
Hello, sugar in my coffee. It makes me be.
I'm Woody Overton, host of Real Life, Real Crime, the podcast. Join me each week to hear true and unscripted stories of the cases I actually worked during my career as a major crime investigator in South Louisiana. Go to reallifeRealCrime.com where you can listen to each week's episodes and find links to our social media. I appreciate y'all. Don't let me catch you down on the bayou.